for this semester. And we have the pleasure for this time to have Dr. Pedro Castro from INETI in Portugal to be the speaker. Pedro actually has been very active in the area of scheduling, and I would say probably he's right now the major person who's dealing with resource task network. He's done some very nice contributions with RTN in different contexts, doing especially first continuous time, cyclic scheduling type of formulations. And I thought that it would be maybe a good thing to take advantage of his visit for him to give us sort of a tutorial on RTN, because as you see, it's a very nice, powerful concept for scheduling, but at the same time, it's not always, immediately transparent. So Pedro will then, share his thoughts with us. Okay, so without further ado, here's Pedro. So, Pedro.
Okay, welcome. Hi, good morning.
Can you speak now?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me, what I'm saying? Is this okay, this level?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can get you on the phone.
Okay, sure. Today I'm going to talk about how the Resource Task Network can help you solve scheduling problems. I'm currently an assistant researcher at INETI, which is a national research laboratory in Portugal, who is being currently under restructuration so that it will focus mainly on energy-related subjects. So, I will now start in slide 2. In the outline of this presentation, I'm going to start by giving a small introduction where I will characterize scheduling problems and propose a solution strategy that will enable you to address hopefully all kinds of scheduling problems in a systematic way. Then, the main issue is the resource task network process representation. So, for you to be able to understand and use it, I will be giving some fundamental concepts and giving instructions on how one can generate a network based on the problem data. One important issue in scheduling formulations is the treatment of time. There can be at least 3 different types of approaches. I will be discussing those that use the resource task network. So there can be discrete time, continuous time, or even unit-specific approaches. Finally, and to keep you guys interesting, I will give 3 industrial case studies, which are very different in a way, but are here to show that, in fact, the resource task network is versatile enough to solve a wide variety of problem features. So, and then I will finish with the conclusions. Moving on to slide number 4. So, scheduling can be defined in a very general way. So it is basically concerned with the allocation of resources over time so as to execute the processing tasks required to manufacture a given set of products. This is a very general definition, and what I want to highlight is that there are 3 important entities here. It's resources, tasks, and time. And so we'll be coming to this in a moment. A variety of methods can be used to solve a scheduling problem. This talk will focus on mathematical programming approaches. And for scheduling problems, the solution is represented in the form of a Gantt chart. So, on the bottom left, I show the schematic of a simple process involving a multi-stage process. So, in order to produce a given product, FP, you start with a raw material that has to go through 3 consecutive stages. On each of these stages, there are parallel units that can be used to perform the task. And on the right, I show what a solution would look like. So one could have the first product allocated consecutively into the stages, and you need to ensure that production in stage 2 only goes only can start after production in stage 1 has finished. And we are typically given a given time horizon, which we must meet. And the blocks with patterns without numbers are just saying that in some cases there may be changeovers involved. And these may be sequence dependent or not. Okay? So, moving on to slide number 5. Of course, scheduling problems are very complex, and this is because there is generally a wide variety of features that can arise. This may be dependent on the type of network structure that one has. We may have flow shop or job shop plans, also known as multi-stage or multi-purpose plans. We may have issues like storage, the product due dates, production just in time, other utilities that need to be considered, such as manpower, steam, electricity, and so on. We have batch and continuous plans. Depending on the type of demand pattern that we have for the products, we may need to address a short-term scheduling problem if the demand changes frequently, or in contrast, if you have stable production in campaigns or a stable demand pattern for an extended period of time, like months or weeks, several weeks or months, you may go for periodic scheduling. And of course, there are different objective functions that one may want, such as minimizing cost, maximizing profit, or minimizing max pain. So, moving to slide number 6. So, my vision is that we want to address this systematically. So, I've been working on since my PhD thesis in trying to come up with a general model that can cope with such a variety of features. And even though every time a new problem comes along, there may be some adjustments required to widen even further its scope, I can say this is mostly that. Then, of course, we want to solve the resulting mathematical problems efficiently, so we also need to explore ways of improving efficiency for special types of problems, and this is currently work that is being done. And in the future, we have to allow to research on the composition techniques that keep the resulting solution close to the optimal ones, but that can allow us to solve large-scale problems with relatively few computational resources. Okay, so now to slide number 7. The strategy that I will follow and what I want to emphasize is that one should separate the description of the problem from the mathematical formulation that you are going to use. So first, you will be concerned about describing the problem. So you will be gathering information from the process. This can be from the process flow sheet, if it's more like a continuous process, or else if it's a batch process, there you may need to look at into the process recipe and into the equipment that are suitable for a particular task. After you do this, after you collect this information, then you need to be concerned about how to generate the resource task network that represents this process. And basically, in this process, you will be converting real entities like units, products, equipment and utilities into virtual entities, the ones that are used by the resource task network. And these are the resources and the tasks. Okay, so in the second part, you now have a representation of the process, and you can look into the available mathematical formulations based on the resource task network that are available. And if these are not good enough, you can think about developing your own. And again, time is a critical issue, because depending the constraints and variables will change slightly depending on the time representation that one will be using to solve the problem, either a discrete or a continuous time. So, now in slide number 8 and 9, so I will be focusing now on the resource task network process representation so that you hopefully can understand it. The resource task network has been proposed by Kostas Pantelidis, a professor in Imperial College, back in 1994, and it basically views the processes as comprising two entities, the resources and the tasks. The resources will be represented in the diagram as a circle, and it's a totally general concept that includes equipments, materials, utilities, cleaning states, location for material, and so on. And tasks are represented as a rectangle and just transform one set of resources into another set. So your first step then is to identify your process resources and tasks, and then you need to relate to see what interactions are involved with the resources and tasks. Slide number 10. So, some of you may already have heard about the state task network. And what are the differences between the state task network, which I have to say is actually used by more researchers, but not me. I think that resource task network is much better, and I'm going to explain why. If you look at the state task network and to a description of a simple process like the one that I'm showing, you don't see any information about the equipment units that are required to perform these three tasks that I show here, because this will be implicit in your model constraints. In contrast, in the resource task network, the equipment units are treated explicitly. And as one main difference is that if you have a certain task that needs to be performed in multiple units, that there are a few alternative units to perform them, then you need to disaggregate this task, which in this case is this make E task, into two different tasks. One, if it is performed on unit 1, and the other, if it's performed on unit 2. And I will come to the explanation of the arrows in a moment. Okay, so this is the main issue. Of course, if there are many tasks that can be performed on many units, then this representation can explode. And it may be difficult to generate the diagram. Now, moving on to slide number 11, critical points is that in the resource task network, you assume the resources will be treated uniformly, it is also true that it may be convenient to distinguish between different resource types. So I show here a diagram on the right where there are different types of resources. First, the equipment units with a white background, M1 and M2. These are resources that are consumed temporarily by the process task. So, and this is why there is a double arrow connecting them to the tasks. It is also as they are also dashed lines, because this is to emphasize that there is a discrete interaction. So, for instance, the first task, make P1 in M1, will consume the resource when it starts and regenerates the resource back to the system when it ends. So this is the meaning of the double arrows. There are other possibilities, of course. If we have material resources, these are either consumed permanently or produced permanently. For instance, raw materials we consume and never give it back. So in this, the returning back to the same blue task, it might be one task. In this case, this will be a continuous task characterized by a processing rate. So we'll be consuming the raw material while producing the intermediate P1M at the same time. And there are also other types of resources. For instance, utilities may have a certain known profile over the time horizon. So for the task to start, we must make sure that we have enough utility available. So this will correspond to a discrete consumption in the start of the task. There are three types of tasks that can be used. Batch tasks, and this all started to address batch problems, but this is not the only case. We can use the resource task network to address continuous plants as well. So batch tasks are particularly useful also to model changeovers and storage tasks. In this case, this make P1, M2, the red task closer to the bottom, is similar to the first one. The only difference is now this is a batch task. So it consumes a certain amount of raw material in the beginning, notice the dashed line, and it produces another amount of product at the end. And batch tasks can either be a fixed duration or a duration that is actually dependent on the batch size. So this allows us to model a wide range of features. I already talked about continuous tasks, and there may also be instantaneous tasks. Those tasks that take much shorter time than the others. So they can occur, they are assumed to occur instantaneously. And in this case, you can use them for modeling material transfer for between different units, if one needs to know which connections are required between the different units, or also if one wants to ensure that the product demands are met, You may think of an instantaneous task that removes a certain amount of product from the system, so that the model needs to ensure that we have enough in the solution. Okay, so, but I have to say that to come up with a resource task network, there may be some imagination involved so that you can find the proper set of tasks of resources, and there are usually more than one option, as I will show in a moment. But now, in the slide number 12, I've talked a little about how one could generate the resource task network diagram, but now you need to take this information into the model. And for that, you'll be using what I call the structural parameters of the resource task network. But before I present them, I have to say that tasks will be characterized by two different sets of variables. We will be using one binary variable n to indicate if the task I starts at event point t. So this is related to the number of events that we are allowing in the time grid. I will return to this in a moment. If you use for special types of tasks, you may require another time index, but I'm not complicating things now. Besides the binary extent variables n, we also have continuous variables c, which will normally give the amount handled by the task, but these variables can be used for other purposes as well. So, to relate the resources with the task, we'll be using five different sets of structural parameters. And this will either give the total resource consumption or production that is involved, or as an alternative, and I will explain this in a moment, they can give you the proportion relatively to the amount handled by the task. And these mu and lambda parameters will differ on whether we have discrete interactions or continuous interactions, and on whether if these are related to the binary extent variables or to the continuous extent variables. And fortunately, this is there are some parameters involved, but fortunately the large majority will be equal to zero, and for those that are not, they will mostly be either one or minus one. And I have to say that after some practice, they can be easily generated, and you don't even need to generate the complex RTM diagram. So you can skip that part and immediately generate the structural parameters. So, now in slide 13, I'm giving an example where assume that you have a batch reaction where you want to consume 10 tons of A and to produce 8 tons of B and 2 tons of C. And since this is an exothermic reaction, you may need 5 tons per hour of cooling water. So, as a first option, you can think of this recipe in absolute terms, in the absolute quantities that I've just specified. And if you do that, you only need to use the binary variables n to identify the task, because if you say that this reaction task is taking place, though, then we are consuming 10 tons of A, and so you can see them in the diagram, the parameter mu that says that for resource A is involved in task I and is consuming an amount of minus 10. So this identifies the minus, identifies the consumption. And when the task ends, we are producing 8 tons of B and 2 tons of C. Besides this, we will need a reactor for the reaction to take place, and as I have illustrated before, so we consume one unit of the reactor at the start of the task and give it back at the end, and also we will be required in the cooling water. So this is the first option. Now the second option is a more general approach. And this is because you treat the recipe in relative terms. And this may be useful if you do not know for sure the amount that should be handled in the task. And you want to decide that, you want to leave that decision for the solver to take care of. So, in this case, you'll be also using the continuous extent variables C. And also, if you set C to 10, you reduce to option number 1, although you use more variables than before. So now, what you basically do is that you'll be dividing the new parameters by 10 to get to the new parameters. And so you can see now that we are now, for each unit of whey that we are consuming, we are using we are consuming one unit of whey, so minus one in the new parameter A to Y, and we are producing 0.8. So these are the relative amounts. So for each unit of whey consumed, we are producing 0.8 of B and 0.2 of C. And the only resource that doesn't change the parameters is, of course, the equipment units, so, because provided that it has enough volume or enough capacity to handle the task, so regardless of the amount that is being processed, you always need one unit to start with. So here you can see that there may be more than one way of representing your process. So, moving on to slide number 14 and 15, I will now be concerning with modeling time in the resource task network scheduling formulations. And there are basically two different options. You can either rely on an explicit time grid, and for that you may use just a single time grid, which is also known as using global time intervals. And all these time grids will use a given number of time or event points, and this number is equal to t. So if you have a discrete time, the time horizon will be divided into uniform time intervals of a fixed length, delta, that I will describe in a moment. In continuous time, you have the same set of event points, but the number will be generally smaller. And another alternative is that you may rely on multiple time grids. So as many of the continuous time grids, you'll be using one of the continuous time grids for each equipment resources. And the work by Chris Kruders at Princeton has focused mainly on this case. As an alternative to the use of explicit time grids, you may rely on sequencing variables, which can be very useful for specific types of processes. And this may have variables that give you immediate precedence. For instance, if the grab task takes place before the dark, it immediately precedes the dark immediately precedes the yellow, and so on. As an alternative, you can reduce the number of variables by considering general precedence of tasks. And in this case, the red task will globally precede both the black, but also the yellow and the green. So, moving on to slide 16, what is common to all resource task network models, and this is the core of the resource task network, is the use of the excess resource variables, R. And this will keep track of resource availability over time. And I will give an example in the next slide for you to better understand. In the case of continuous tasks, there may be required another set of these variables, which will give the excess amount immediately available before the end of a certain time interval. In resource task network models, equipment units are treated individually. So we'll be considering that they have an excess amount, a maximum excess amount equal to 1. We'll be using multi-period mass balances expression, so everything at a certain event point is related to the amount available at the previous event point, so we have to start somewhere, and for that we define an initial resource availability, which is often known for all resources. But in some cases it may be advantageous to treat them as variables. For instance, in design and scheduling problems where you pre-postulate enough equipment units to address some process, and you want to model to select the best units to use for those tasks. And I will have an example later on that talks about this. Resources may come in and out of the system at specific points in time, and we can model this by using discrete inputs and outputs. As an heuristic, when you have your scheduling model, you should try to fix the excess resource variables to zero at all event points for as many resources as possible. By doing this, you reduce solution degeneracy and ensure that all the tasks take place sequentially. And this is good for the performance of the model. So, now, in slide 17, So the excess resource balances are what is important in the RTM. And this is where the structural parameters come into action. I've just mentioned that these are multi-period balance expressions, and I'm not going into that into detail. Instead, I'm giving an illustration for you to understand how this works for equipment resources. So, I suppose that you have a certain time grid comprised of the seven event points, the T, and let us suppose now that we have two tasks being performed starting at event point 2, task 1, and starting at event point 4, task number 2. And these are performed on a certain equipment unit, let's call it M1. So, no task is starting at the first event point. For the equipment unit is available for the system, so the initial availability, the first term highlighted on the left, has a contribution of 1 to the system. And since no task is starting, the value of the excess resource variable is equal to 1. We move on to the second event point. In this point, the task is starting, so on the second term that is highlighted, you multiply the structural parameter mu times the binary variable m, so this will have a minus 1 contribution, which cancels out the value from the previous interval, so we reduce the value of the excess resource variable to 0. Only to give it back at event point number 3 when the task completes, so now it's the new parameter that relates the resources at the end of the task, so this is as a plus 1 contribution, and again we have the resource available. So at event point 4, again, the excess resource variable turns to 0. And this excess value is just meaning that when you have an excess amount equals to 0, it just means that the unit is already allocated to a certain task, so it cannot be used in other tasks. This is what the concept of excess resource means. And if you want, for example, to make sure that a given unit is unavailable, for instance, due to maintenance reasons, you should actually turn the excess resource variable to 1 rather than 0, which will be the intuitive way of thinking. Okay, so now in slide 18, I'm starting to give more details about mathematical formulations, but not too many. I have to say that the discrete time model is the most powerful approach overall. It can handle problems of industrial relevance, as I will show, and basically it is because it gives rise to a very tight mixed integer linear programming formulation. And besides this, and as soon as you can manage the structural parameters generation, it gives rise to a rather simple and elegant formulation. Besides the excess resource constraints that I've shown before, there are only a few more being required. I show here three. These three, they just relate the two sets of extant variables, the binary variables N with the continuous variables C, which ensure that we do not exceed the amount that we are handling the task does not exceed the capacity of the vessel, for instance. Then we have, as the second set of constraints, the bounds on the excess resource variables. And, for instance, we may have operational constraints that say that we need to ensure that a particular task is executed at least one over the time horizon. So you can see that there are few constraints, so this is not difficult to understand the model. Okay, a critical modeling issue in the discrete time formulation is that you are assuming that all time intervals have the same length, which is a parameter that you specify. So, and since you are always specifying the number of time points, the time horizon is fixed. So, this parameter delta may be difficult to set. There is usually a trade-off involved. On the one hand, you have that data accuracy. The smaller the number, the more accurate the data will be. But you'll be increasing severely the size of the mathematical problem, and you may risk coming out with an intractable problem. So the example that I show here in this table, you can see that I start with delta equals to 10, still a
10 minutes or 10?
In this case, it was, I don't know, it was 10.
Okay.
10, just to keep it relative. So for delta equals to 10, we give rise to a relatively small size problem. We have a value of objective function which we aim to minimize. Cost will be equal to 91, and we reach this solution in 5.3 seconds. But this is not the optimal solution. So since we have to round up the data to ensure that the solution is feasible, we no longer can fit the optimal solution into the time horizon, and we get a suboptimal solution. We can make the problem more accurate by reducing delta. For delta equals to 5, the computational effort increases substantially. We improve the solution, but it's still not the optimal solution. That is obtained with delta equals to 2 in 40 seconds. The optimal solution is equal to 89. Of course, accurate data is only considered in this case for delta equals to 1, and you get the same solution, but you can see that the computational effort has raised from 40 seconds to more or less half an hour. And from delta equals to 10, you can see that the problem size has increased 10 times. But it's still manageable since the formulation is very tight. And I think in this case, the integrality gap was equal to 0. So it's just finding up the first solution, and usually it takes 0 nodes in the branch and bound tree.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, sure.
Why does the computational time fall when you set the discrete? When you set the discretization to 2,
yeah,
why does it fall? Why does the CPU time fall from 150 to 40?
Basically, it's because of the integrality gap. For instance, if the solution of the relaxed problem is also 89 for delta equals to 5, it can have some trouble in closing the gap. Whereas when it goes to 2, then the solution of the relax is equal to 89, and it typically the first solution that it found is the optimal one, so it actually takes less time, even if it's a larger problem. So there are a few things involved. Was that clear?
But in general, when you reduce your discretization to smaller and smaller value, the problem size becomes bigger and bigger, and your computational time should also go up, right, in general?
In general, yes, but there is also the integrality gap involved. So, as the problem data becomes more accurate, you can also be closing up the gap. So,
okay.
you can speed up things.
If I can briefly interject, let's remember branch and bound is non-deterministic search. So, it is not generally true that if you increase the size, the time goes up. Okay, so that is only true when you solve, for example, systems of equations, when you say it's order n cube, n squared, n cube, depending on how you solve it. In branch and bound, you cannot necessarily make the statement that the larger the problem is, the more time it's going to take. It's generally true, but it's not necessarily true.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So let's move on to slide number 19. And now I'm discussing the continuous time model. Again, you'll be using a time grid with T event points, which will be fewer generally. And this continuous time model is a more general approach, and it can handle a much wider variety of features rigorously. Unfortunately, it's also significantly more complex overall. And besides the type of constraints that I've shown before, you'll be needing some additional sets of timing variables and timing constraints, which will give the absolute time of the event point on the grid. So, whereas in the discrete time, you know right from the start the location of all time points, and you know the time associated to them, and this is very useful to model events that occur at specific points in time. In continuous time, you do not know a priori where a certain event point will be placed, and you need to determine this event points. So this is the basic constraint that I've shown here. I'm not describing it. I just want to emphasize that critical modeling issues of the continuous time model is that you need to use two indexes to handle batch tasks, and this causes serious difficulties. And of course, the most well known is that you can only assure global optimal solutions when the number of event points tends to infinity. And this is not very practical. What you usually do is that you start with a relatively small number of event points, and you solve the problem and go one by one, single increase in the number of event points until you exceed your computational resources, or you find that there is no improvement in the objective function. So the example I shown here, I start with t equals to 8. You can see that the solver finds that there is no solution. The problem is infeasible in 0.6 seconds. I get a single increase going to 9. I get a feasible solution equals to 27. The computational effort has increased significantly. And then we increase to 10 to see if the solution for 9 was the best one. No. Actually, you can do better. We can find 27.0. And if we keep increasing for t equals to 11, we even find a better solution equal to 26.9. And while doing this, the computational effort increased by one order of magnitude, which is just showing, and this is all sort of like an heuristic for us for these types of problems, because I've been addressing a variety of them, and this is actually holds quite well. So for every single increase in t, you get a one order of magnitude increase in computational effort, which brings some difficulties. So we don't know from where to start, how many event points should one use, and if you specify too large a number, you probably won't be finding any good solution. So, and to further make this point, this solution for 11 event points in this case is not even the optimal solution for this problem. So you need at least one more event point. What is good about this formulation is that you can always find so it is totally general. So with an infinite number of event points, you should find the optimal solution for every problem. Okay? So now, moving on to slide number 20, I discussed briefly about unit-specific models. They use one continuous time grid for each unit. They have shown to be significantly better in special types of problems, those involving multi-stage processes or sequential processes. Are the example, and these formulations have been shown to be very competitive with the sequence-based models, which can only address these types of problems. Also, they have been shown, and Fluda's group has been doing a lot of work for multipurpose plants without shared resources. These have also been shown to be very, very good. Of course, this occurs because with unit-specific models, you can assume without loss of generality that all tasks can last one time interval. So we only be needing one time index, and this is very good because with that you will get fewer number of event points to find the global optimal solutions. And again, I give a simple example. You can see that the three formulations could indeed find the minimum cost of 793. The discrete time required to use accurate data, so a very large number of time points, 1,500. The continuous time required significantly less, only 7, but it was actually the one taking the highest amount of computational resources. If we go for unit-specific models, multiple time grids, you only need 4 event points, and you can get the solution really fast. So from this, you can also have an idea of the size of the mathematical problems that is involved. So the discrete time is orders of magnitude larger. Okay, so I'm now going to describe the case studies. In the first, this was something done on my PhD thesis. So when we were concerned into the optimization of the cooking section of a sulfite pulp mill. Now, in slide 22, the characteristics of the problem is that we had a system of 4 parallel batch digesters to produce the pulp. And as part of the cooking process, we have to heat the reactor contents up to the cooking temperature and leave it there for a few hours. In this process, the heating stage was the bottleneck. And we all of the times there were 2 digesters that will be sharing steam simultaneously. And this steam, the heating utility, was at the time not available in as much of quantity as one would want. So what happened is that this heating task must follow certain rules. We cannot heat it up too quickly, otherwise the quality of the pulp will degrade. So I show this diagram here representing that if digester DI is the one further ahead, it will be using most of the steam, and the part that is not being used will be directed to the to the reactor that is immediately follows in the schedule. Since these digesters have different capacities, the digester sequence will actually affect the cycle time. And so we wanted to find which was the best sequence for the plant. So I'm just showing here the resource task network or the description of the heating task. So the slide number 23, sorry. So I generated all these tasks, and since this we aimed at searching for other digester sequences different than the ones in use at the plant, so we had to perform some dynamic simulation to predict the value or the duration of these tasks, because depending on the initial temperature that one gets from the other digester, from steam that is made available from the other digester, the subsequent heating tasks may take shorter or longer. So in this case, the resources, I just want to emphasize that the resources actually corresponded to different temperatures of the materials inside the digester. Moving on to slide 24, we found a new optimal sequence, which was different than the one in use at the plant. In this case, the production rate was 1% higher, a lower cycle time of 564 minutes. And this was accomplished using a periodic discrete time scheduling formulation with accurate data, so a time grid with 1 minute time grids for a cycle time of 564. So this will be the number of time points that one would need. The continuous time approach, on the other hand, we can only find an optimal cycle time of 584, and it took a lot of hours of computational time at the time. And this was because the problem became intractable. The continuous time can always find this solution, but you'll be requiring a larger number of event points that you could use at the time. So, now to the second case study. In the second case study, slide 25, I will be describing how to optimize byproducts recycling on a tissue paper mill. And this slide 26, this problem occurred on a Scandinavian tissue paper mill. In this case, it was a continuous plant. It involved five products, different qualities of paper, according to their brightness, where P50 would be the darkest quality and P85 the brightest one. So this is basically can be considered like a two-stage process, where you have the inking line and then you have the paper machines. And what happens is that there are some losses in the paper machines where part of the fiber is lost as broke. So we want to recycle this broke back to the inking line so that we save on the raw materials. And at the time, what they were doing was that they will collect all the broke regardless of the paper quality, and they will use as a replacement for the cheap raw material, only to produce the lower quality products, let's say. And so the raw materials in this case were old newspaper, ONP, mixed office waste, MOW, and virgin fiber, the expensive one. So which would be the raw material of the brightest quality, P85. So what we proposed in slide 27, so again we derived the resource task network in order to incorporate recycling. So this is not common in your typical scheduling problem. There is usually no recycling involved. In this case there was. So we wanted to evaluate the option of not mixing broke from different qualities. So we pre-postulated three different qualities of broke depending on the raw material that they would be replacing. So there will be broke 85 to replace virgin fiber in the production of P85, broke 80 to replace mixed office waste in the production of P80, and the other darker quality broke to replace old newspaper. And so this is what we went to study. In slide 28, I can show an overview of the results. We achieved a profit that was 1.5% higher, and this because of the double benefit of reducing the amount of raw material that one was needing, and also not having disposal costs. So in this chart that I've shown here, if you look at, there are 3 points which show the profit in relative amounts. The one further to the left, there are the schedules down. Up, there is this chart tend to illustrate the profile of broke that it is in storage. There are 3 points. So the first is for no recycling. With no recycling, you can see that broke builds up to an amount of 100 tons in the cycle that we need to dispose of. In the current strategy, you can see that there is some of the broke that it starts decreasing, then it raises, and then decreases again. And these points in the extreme parts of the charts differ for something like 40 tons. So this just means that you cannot take care of all the broke that you are generating, since there are some constraints on the production. You can only go and use as much as 20% of the broke. You can see that in the future strategy, there is no net accumulation of broke. So this will be the third point on the right. You can see there is some accumulation in some points in the cycle, but this goes down to zero. So there is no amount of broke that needs to be disposed of when you'll be using fewer raw materials. In this case, the continuous time formulation was the one leading to the best results. It was a mixed integer nonlinear programming, since we were optimizing profit, so dividing the total amount produced by the cycle time which was available. All other constraints in this case were of the linear type. It was just the objective function that was nonlinear. Okay, now moving to the third case study on slide 29, we address a problem coming from a fine chemicals plant, and we wanted to find out the optimal equipment allocation. So, in slide 30, the problem that we have is that this fine chemicals plant produces several active pharmaceutical ingredients. And this may come a few each week, and the company needs to decide whether to accept the orders and to price, which price they should use to say if the customer accepts. And this mostly has to do with the equipment units that are available to produce the active pharmaceutical ingredient. So basically what the problem is all about is that the more units you allocate to a certain active pharmaceutical ingredient, you will produce this API as fast as you can, and you'll be reducing the make span. But if you use too many units, you'll be leaving fewer units to produce other APIs that may come along, so you're actually decreasing the flexibility of the plant, and maybe so you may be risking out on important business opportunities. So I show now the resource task network, part of the resource task network for this problem. It is a sequential process where to produce the API, there were four intermediate chemicals involved that needed to be synthesized. What I want to emphasize here is that we were not using in this problem the real equipment units to generate the resource task network. Instead, we used virtual equipment units. What are these virtual units? Is that, for instance, in the first task, the one further to the left and to the top, this requires a reactor, a resource R1, and this must have a certain type. In this case, it was an hydrogenator, which was a special type of reactor. Depending on the chemical that is involved, it needs to be made up of a certain material. In this case, it was not glass. I don't know if you can read it. But the materials that were considered was acetalloy, stainless steel, and glass. So in this case, it could be either stainless steel or acetalloy. And it also has, we also want to ensure that the unit has a certain minimum capacity, in this case, in terms of volume. And there are also other equipments that are not vessels, like filters and dryers and so on. So there were four different types of equipments being considered. And the scheduling model, we'll have to make the correspondence of these virtual entities to the real units available at the plant. So now in slide 31, this chart again tries to illustrate what is going on. I have to say that in terms of the representation of the optimal cost, in terms of the cycle time, we have quite an erratic chart, and this is because of issues related to periodic scheduling. And the fact that all tasks need to take place sequentially, so they go immediately one after the other. So there are some issues involved that give this type of shot. What I want to emphasize here is that as you go from left to right, there are generally less units being used. So actually, in this case, more units being represented on the chart actually means less units being used. So for a cycle time of 9 and 10 8-hour shifts, these are 8-hour periods, you'll need to use all the units except unit M1, whereas as you go to a longer cycle time, you'll be using significantly fewer units, but you will also be increasing the make span, and your cost will be significantly higher. So this chart was generated by solving several times the discrete time model for a different value of the number of time points of the cycle time, and in this case we could generate all these points in just 1,000 seconds. So this was also reasonable. And the three highlighted solutions deserve a better analysis. So, moving on to slide 32, we had to produce actually 20 batches of this particular API, and you can see that the fastest production of the API, the chart closer to the left, we achieved this in 78 days and 2 shifts. And this will be the schedule, and you'll see that all equipments are being used because we've removed M1 from the representation. The second option, and this the one further to the right, also on the top, is the actual optimal solution. And now you increase a bit the make span to 91 days and 1 shift, but you no longer need to use unit M6, neither unit M13. And this is because you can use some equipment units, for instance M8 and M14, to produce tasks belonging to different chemicals. The problem is that every time you need to use to use the same equipment for different chemicals, very large changeovers are involved. In this case, we're equal to 3 8-hour periods, 1 day, and since this is a periodic schedule showing, so to switch for a task 1 of product B in M8 to task 2 of product E, you'll need one changeover to get from E to E, and then another to return back to E. So there has to be enough time available, and this is why only by increasing the cycle time you can reduce the number of units. Finally, the third solution, you can see there are even fewer equipments being used, more changeovers taking place, and this will take 160 days and 2 shifts. Okay, so to conclude, I've been able to show that there is a wide variety of complex scheduling problems out there, and the resource task network is probably your best option to handle these problems. As soon as you can dominate the way of generating the network and generating the structural parameters, then you can use this concept for different types of problems and so on, and hopefully be helpful for your company. And again, one important point that I've made is that the procedure of describing the process in terms of a resource task network should be independent on the mathematical formulation that is going to be used to solve the problem. And I've shown two different conceptual models that can be used and provided some guidelines on the best one to use for a certain case. And in the industrial case studies that I've shown, there were of different varieties, they were not similar in any way, and these have been tackled, and we were happy with this. But of course, there is still a lot of research to be done to render this approach even more efficient and disseminate them in industry, hopefully. Okay, so I'll leave you in slide 35 with some references that you can use to understand more about the resource task network. And I will like to thank you for listening to me, and I will welcome any questions that you may have. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Are there any questions out there for Pedro? Not really. Well, maybe can I ask a general question? I mean, it does appear that given that, for example, CPLEX is becoming more and more efficient at solving larger scale problems, that probably the incentive for going to use a continuous time is in a way decreasing, because I think it appears you can use discrete time with a fairly small resolution of time. So can you comment, in other words, a bit, because I think maybe 10 years ago, as an example, MLP was much slower, and in that sense the effect on the discrete time was much bigger, and now discrete time has become really much more competitive. So the question is there any point in still pursuing continuous time models?
No, of course, that was the main incentive for people starting to looking at continuous time formulations. I say that the discrete time is usually your best approach, but this is not for all problems, as I illustrated. What I find good about the discrete time approach is that by adjusting that delta parameter, you can take advantage of the accuracy of the problem. So you can generate simpler problems that are not that accurate, but at least will give you some valuable insights about the solution. And if you can hopefully solve it with a higher resolution, then you can even go better solutions. But at least the discrete time provides a fast way of always getting some information that may be useful to you. The continuous time may be very good in other types of problems, mostly for sequential type of processes. These have been shown to be quite powerful. But again, I'm not sure that they will be able to address problems of industrial size in an efficient way. So most of the work that has been done has focused on toy problems, and there are still a lot of research to do to find ways of improving them and perhaps doing some simplifications to make them more efficient.
Okay, thank you very much. So any more questions out there? Okay, all right. So let me just mention our next seminar will be by Andrew Schaefer on generation of scenarios for stochastic programming. I believe it's October the 8th, but I'll, of course, send you all email. And those of you who are coming on the 29th and 30th, we look forward to seeing you then here. Okay? The other thing, we will be placing the presentation on the website, and Fenji has actually also recorded the talk, so you have both the image and the voice. Okay? So thank you very much, and see you then next time. And again, thank you to Pedro for a very nice presentation. Okay? See you then. Bye. Okay? Bye-bye.
Thanks. Thank you.